How does an individual return from the far reaches of certain terrible experiences, from being in the trenches of the Somme, crawling through the sewers of the Warsaw Ghetto, being in cities bombed to oblivion, Dresden, Coventry, Nagasaki, Hiroshima, from the many bombings and attacks around the world today, provoking huge numbers of people trying to escape violence and death by fleeing to Europe, and to risk death by doing so, and from the severe subsequent rise in anti-immigrant rhetoric and in prejudice. In his essay, Experience and Poverty, Walter Benjamin writes that the experience was traditionally transferred through stories and proverbs from one generation to the next, but that the incommunicably tragic atrocities of the First World War had interrupted this process, making it impossible. His book, The Storyteller, is on sale outside, and he writes in this, "With the war came the severing of the red thread of experience which had connected previous generations. The fragile human body that emerged from the trenches was mute, unable to narrate the force field of destructive torrents and explosions that had engulfed it. It was as if the good and bountiful soil of the fable had become the sticky and destructive mud of the trenches, which would bear no fruit, but only moulder as a graveyard." As with the war that Benjamin was reflecting on, it seemed that experiences of massive destruction are always too much for us to bear, really knowing and understanding. Our minds can only take in a certain amount of horror. So what becomes of the rest of the experience which we resist? Those who knew from the experiences the horrors of the Somme could not tell its stories, the friends, body parts, insanities, the enemy, the reasons were all muddled up and coloured darkly. Detail was kept for the realms of the private nightmare and not for telling others. Other than our family members and close friends, most of us do not witness the dying and the dead. Seeing the dying and the dead in massive numbers overwhelms the human mind. For centuries, states have been adept at instigating and manipulating ideal qualities that they desire their citizens to have, as well as projecting negative qualities onto the other. The virulent propaganda in both directions demanded that each side of the 1914-18 conflict believed that God was on their side and not the other. After the conflict ended, millions of soldiers returned in silence, bringing home their war despair. Well, let me go back in time. In medieval times, when most villagers never went more than a few miles beyond their habitations and fields, it was true that what was a little further beyond was unknown. Such territory was imagined to be, as told in fables, lands of giants, warriors, dangerous sirens. Today, however, what used to be imagined is no longer imagined. The question is, what has this done to our human mind, our collective narratives about the world, acting as our unconscious imaginative frame, perhaps no longer able to hold the immensity of the violent images within it? And if such images are beyond the strength of our minds, what is the consequent impact on our values and character formations? Are we becoming hardened in our relations with the other, drawn to destructiveness, aggression, sadomasochism? It's easier for many people who do not want to find a place for such things in their mind to avoid all knowledge of them, leading to severe splitting and a general contempt for knowledge in such areas. The recently political cry is, therefore, experts have no value. That's all of us here today, of course. Horrid things that are known can become encrypted, almost lost, and can form the core of the dynamic of severe individual trauma in the child. If no adult sees the attacks on the body and the mind of the abused child, denial develops in the developing mind of the victim into a lasting capacity to not see. Like the black bags covering the windows, the eyes of that patient this morning. Perhaps in today's world, the banal concept of mindfulness has its root in the commonality, mindfulness my unconscious, has its roots in the commonality of mindlessness. I really don't like that word, you can hear that. As in Bluebeard's castle, in which the murdered wives are locked away, hidden knowledge is only an invitation to continue perverse functioning. Or we can take the petrification of the writhing bodies in Pompeii at the moment of the volcanic eruption as a vivid metaphor for the rigidity and fixity of the mind following massive trauma. Better stay fixed, rigid, and without sight, without insight. The scenes are too much for humankind to bear. But let us go slow. Myths, legends, stories have perhaps been idealized precisely because they have over the centuries been changed and developed so that they are acceptable to grown-ups and their children. For example, the original Grimm Brothers fairy tales, published in 1812, with further increasingly milder revisions being regularly published up to the final edition in 1857. There'd be no English translation until Jack Zeeps did one in 2014. The original tales were changed significantly in the later editions that were used for the previous translations. For instance, in the original, How the Children Played at Slaughtering. There's a title for your children. The children play a game in which one is a butcher and the other are the pigs. It ends with a boy cutting his brother's throat and then being stabbed by his mother in fury. The child that she'd left alone in the bath then drowns, and the returning father, overwhelmed by despondency, soon dies. And so they all die well beyond the notion that families can sustain life. In a similar, less sanitized version, Rapunzel, following a merry time with the prince and unaware of biological consequences, exclaims, "Tell me, Mother Gothel, why are my clothes becoming too tight?" So from the classics to today's sound bites. The impact of journalism has been softened through its transformation into these easily digested bits of information that gesture towards a particular matter without going into the detail that might and ought to disturb the reader. As you said, you hope to disturb with your poem. And the reader can then easily, swiftly pass on to the next item. News is presented in rapid compilation, such that each story has a similar valence. We're enabled in scanning over them, moving quickly past potential disturbances to our emotional life in the quest to be superficially up to date with everything that's happening. At the same time, when it was last counted recently, 968 million Facebook users were asked each day to share their thoughts and feelings. As Katrina Forrester described, we're prompted to choose from a list of options. Excited is the first option. Happy is the second. If they don't fit, you can scroll through another 120 moods. In 2014, we learned that Facebook gathers this data about our moods and ran experiments in manipulating its users' moods by tailoring news feeds individually to be more happy or more sad. This business model, in which huge numbers of people are each fed a different personalized news based on what they appear to like, is to manipulate their thinking. The social media monolith profits from making what goes on in our heads knowable, legible, and marketable. And this means that we will only be shown the news that our supplier knows will engage our emotional life, filtered rather than raw, so as to maximize our engagement with their platform. On top of this, we've now entered what's been labeled a post-truth world, where significant streams of information and news have a willingly non-existent relationship with both truth and evidence. Google's algorithms recently reflected the scale of this phenomena and the amount of material online that denies the Holocaust by briefly declaring that the Holocaust was a fake. That was the top tick box of Google for a while. So the tick box ease of this 21st century environment ensures we think less in this anodyne state, becoming increasingly vulnerable to the manipulations of news moguls and unscrupulous politicians. Trump rallies showed the power of pleasing the people with barely concealed racism, misogyny, and anti-Semitism, alongside the slogan, "Make America Great Again." Of course, Europe has known this script well with Hitler at the Nuremberg rallies. We know that people can easily give up thinking, basking in the idealization of the leader and his influence. Like the ease of sound bites and clicking yes and no, the political process is diverted away from thought and into a black and white simplicity of splitting us from them, and the people are very happy. The latest DSM classes grief following a bereavement, if it lasts for longer than a couple of months, as a mental disorder. That grief is now a mental disorder. So Big Pharma sells more antidepressants. More insidious than such profit chasing, however, is a new mythology that nothing should move us away from our happy state. In this mindset, mourning is one of the processes that seems to be antithetical to the individual's well-being. That a remembering of the other, as well as our own individual histories, within the context of our complex emotional, relational lives, means being alive in the presence of thinking for ourselves. Totalitarian states hate psychoanalysis, as it wakes the sleeping people from the anti-democratic manipulations of mass psychology. Since the fall of the Berlin Wall, there's been a flourishing of psychoanalysis in Eastern Europe, helping to end such slumbers. Let me return to discussions of matter that are impossible to discuss by telling another story. The German newspaper Bild, in the 15th of August 2014, had a headline, "Step by Step, ISIS Carries Out Genocide." It followed the capture by ISIS of the city of Sinjar in northern Iraq and described the atrocities the group had been inflicting on the local Yazidi community. Enslavement, torture, execution, and a systematic program of rape, victims of which were as young as eight. Philip Sands interviewed Jan Kazilan, the author of an article in the newspaper. He was a German psychologist who was also a Yazidi Kurd. And he relates that he used the word genocide both because it was accurate and also to try and motivate action. He was soon at the center of a project to rescue 1,100 Yazidi women and girls and bring them to Germany where they'd be safe and would receive medical treatment. In Sinjar, ISIS had given the Yazidi the choice of either converting to Islam or being executed. 50,000 were forced to the surrounding mountains where they starved. The community, numbering less than a million, believe in a god who's both good and bad and worship the peacock angel. The peacock angel was first to descend from their god to earth, shedding its colorful feathers. For ISIS, however, the angel is a representation only of the devil, and they call the Yazidi devil worshippers. Either they convert to Islam or are killed with no other possibility. A world of only black and white, with no space for debate, nor space to be alive. Kizilhan visited refugee camps in northern Iraq to assess who to bring back to Germany. His criteria were, had the woman or girl escaped from captivity? Was there evidence of severe abuse and psychological consequences from the period of captivity? Would treatment help beyond that which was available locally? Well, there was none locally. He conducted 1,400 interviews, mainly for half an hour, and described the severe stress involved. He said it was hell to make decisions to decide for that one yes, but another one no. The youngest person he examined was 8 years old. She was sold eight times and raped more than 100 times over a period of 14 months. The case was clear. She came, otherwise she wouldn't survive. One 26-year-old woman who was taken to Germany took her two children with her, 5 and 6 years old. She used to have three. After ISIS executed 21 men from her family, in front of them, including her husband and father, she was sold repeatedly and raped. The last man she was sold to was a foreign fighter called Abu Jihad. He made her learn the Quran. Then, as her Arabic was not good enough, he punished her. He shut her daughter Tuli, who was 2 years old, in a tin box in the courtyard in the heat of Raqqa in August, saying to the mother, "If you take her out, I'll kill the other two children." She was left there for 7 days, after which he took her out, submerged her in ice-cold water, beat her and broke her back, and she died 2 days later. Abu Juhat says to the mother, "This is how the unbelievers will be treated." Kizilhan had difficulty understanding such horror and inhumanity, and can only explain it by assuming that ISIS turned their victims into non-humans in the way that the Nazis did. In Germany, the women and girls were put in groups of about 20, seen weekly for individual psychotherapy and group therapy. There's been a large amount of voluntary support from the community in Königsberg and beyond. The victims will stay in Germany, yet whatever help they're given, there's also a need for justice in order to be able to hope. Tuli's mother, for example, wants the details of her daughter's death to be known widely. She wants the murderer to be punished. Daesh has to be destroyed, and German prosecutors are investigating these crimes. From witnessing such impacts of genocide, whatever the individual's treatment is to help them return from the edge, the necessary component of bringing the perpetrators to justice is clear. The monster must be locked up for the victim to have a better chance of being able to sleep. Importantly, it was also the means that the victim does not need to continue being the one who's unconsciously punished. Justice can, at a deep level of the mind, mitigate the masochism that the vicious and sadistic object demands, as if there has to be a fixed binary parent of sadist and masochist, always linking the oppressor with the victim. It is the same dynamic as in paedophilia, where the perpetrator says to the child, "You like it, really? You even made me do it. In fact, it's your fault," potentially setting off the child for a lifetime of masochistic behavior. What can we do with this modern-day horror story other than ask, how is it possible, and attempt to trace history? We need to move more from our superficial states of knowledge about the world around us to hear and feel whatever comes to mind from specific histories, whether recent or further into the past. So let me go to the past for a bit. The Jews of Lublin, one-third of its population, were wiped out in the Second World War. And just on the outskirts of Lublin is Medanjak, the extermination camp. 43,000 Jews from the city were murdered, leaving just 300 survivors. Today there's a cultural institute in Lublin. It's called the Grodzka Gate, which is dedicated to documenting the lives of those who were killed. It takes its name from the location of the Grodzka Gate, which for centuries divided the Christian part of the city from the Jewish part. There is now, covering what was the Jewish part of the city, a huge car park that's visible from the gate, beneath which the post-war communist authorities buried the old Jewish quarter. The foundations of houses that belonged to the murdered Jews still exist beneath the tarmac veneer. Interviewed for an article, the founder of the Grodzka Gate said that despite this concrete shell, the memories come through. This is not only the disclosure of a forgotten town, but it's a reaction to something that is still a moral issue, saving the memory of what happened there. The communist regime in Poland began in the late 1960s a vicious anti-Semitic campaign, driving away many of the Jews who'd survived and causing a dearth of documentary evidence in the city's library and museum relating to the Jewish population that had been exterminated. And so, in the 1990s, a man called Petrazowicz began collecting stories, small memories, photographs, letters, diaries. We can see a similarity here with the fragmentary process of analysis, collecting tiny pieces of material that have been buried beneath our own individual tarmacs. So far, the Institute has established a file of 900 of the 1,500 homes that once stood in Jewish Lublin, each filled with photographs and documents relating to those living there before it was destroyed. This work, Petrazowicz called Creating an Ark of Memory to Take into the Future. There's a particular poignant room in the artistic installation with the Institute, a dark, foreboding space with many tree trunks that represent the legend of the arrival of Jews in Poland. They found a forest outside of Lublin with trees marked with the word Polin, Hebrew for you should stay here. Polin becomes the Hebrew word for Poland. As Petrasowicz says, what the Nazis wanted to do was not only kill the Jews, but erase any trace of them afterwards, a name which the anti-Semitic Polish communists later contributed. His project is one that strives to confront a dark absence by searching for names and stories as a huge task of building an archive. This is a painful, lengthy, emotional struggle embarked on in an attempt to rescue forgotten history. It goes far beyond the current prevalent mindset in which we chase up our promised quotient of happiness. Lublin can be a beacon of memory and a memorial looking back to the past, at the same time educating the present community by asking, how is this story possible? I suppose it's crucial to acknowledge that the Holocaust is not in the past. As we heard this morning, it has a presence in the present. It is all around, not confined to archive or monochrome, but existing in the here and now. The place in which it occurred is not some distant world, a mythical planet called Auschwitz. It happened in this place, in this town, in this field, as attested to by the project of remembrance and revival in Lublin. In describing these matters, saying how this and this and that are possible, we bring various fragments of history to the surface. This history exists now in this room with all of us together. We must adopt a similar assertive mentality when faced with the current problems of the hate of the other, released in Europe by the British Brexit vote and by vicious Trumpian statements in the last couple of years, allowing, inviting hate talk to be perceived as just ordinary speech. This is our present world, and as psychoanalysts, it's crucial that we speak out wherever there is reprehensible speech around, in our countries, in our cities, with our friends if necessary, and even some of our colleagues. To turn a blind eye is passive acquiescence to the cruel scenes. After all, the dynamics of sadomasochism and hate of the object are well known to us, both in our theories, in our living in the transference and counter-transference of our consulting rooms. Freud lived through the end of the First World War, and witnessed the rise of the Nazis. Yet he was unable to speak against the political times that he lived in. Psychoanalysis needed to be preserved, and perhaps it was too much of a risk, both for him and the preservation of his legacy. He was certainly fearful that psychoanalysis would be seen as a Jewish science and targeted by the Nazis, as his books had been in 1933. But in today's bitter times, it cannot be right that psychoanalysts have nothing to say. As a subject that studies pathology, cruelties, severe states of mind, psychoanalysis has the perceptual tools to help communities, even politicians, to a deeper understanding of the violence within society, and thus to stand our ground against the pull to vilify and blame the other, split off our disturbing characteristics or possible causes for instability or deprivation, in order to relieve ourselves of blame and concern. An example of a vision that counters splitting and hatred can be found in the thought that Norman Foster put into the rebuilding of the Reichstag, which has housed the German parliament since the reunification of Germany in 1990. As part of the restoration, a glass ceiling was installed beneath its dome so that visitors standing above can look down at the parliamentarians debating in the chamber below. It's an eloquent metaphor, the people above the politicians, and openness. It's time for our profession, in addition to listening and talking with our analysts, to speak to society, to describe some of the small human fragments in the events happening around us, and to give witness to the depth of pain within them. Certain descriptions of the state of mind that individuals bring to their analysis can be applied to the states of conflict, splitting, sadomasochism, that lurk on the fringes of society, just awaiting their call. It's time to break the cycle of deadly mimetic violence by refusing to mirror our enemies. I mean that we need to adopt a hard-nosed defiance rather than the sense that nothing can be done except to passively watch. And in order to resist the pull to stand aside, We need to know much more of our own unconscious, destructive and racist states of mind. Zizek provided recently a very incisive reading of The Gap. And he found it following the overthrow of Ceausescu in Romania. Quote, "The rebels, waving the national flag with the red star, the communist symbol, cut out, so that instead of the symbol standing for the organizing principle of national life, communism, there was nothing but a hole in the center. The masses who poured into the streets of Bucharest experienced the situation as open. They participated in the unique intermediate state of passage from one discourse to another when, for a brief passing moment, the hole in the big other, the symbolic order, became visible." Unquote. The symbolism described here is powerful. The empty space in the middle of the flag clearly representing the old communist regime that had been dominated by Ceausescu. Without the dreaded middle that was state control and oppression, the people were able to imagine a new idea of government, one symbolized with a newly found empty flag. A people's uprising can thus force a massive shock into a corrupt society that might lead to a new beginning, in Michael Barlett's terms, of what could be placed in the middle of the flag that represented the people. We can also trace the perception of gaps in the present to, in the tumultuous reactions to the massive migration into the EU. Unconscious fantasies arriving from the imagined meaning of the movement of outsiders into spaces existing or found all over the continent, which disturbs our order. It's as if there are newly found gaps being filled not by their leaders, but by large groups of people from outside. Perhaps it is just the much-reported spectacle of incoming immigrants that provides this fantasy of gaps, in spite of there being leaders and governments still in power. Or perhaps there's a perception in these countries that their leaders are weak, ineffective or corrupt, which allows this sense of the gap to appear. The idea of the gap has as its core the people's fear around what will fill it. In addition, a refinding of the gap as in the hole in the flag harks back, as in après-coup or nachtreidigkeit, to unconscious memories and past fears, reaching back to two world wars that were fought on European soil. Brexit is another large and heady addition to the formation of unconscious psychic gaps, disrupting the old order, both for the UK and Europe, deeply disrupted in their forced separation. And yet another profound gap is looming with Trump's threat to withdraw the US from the Paris Climate Agreement, threats that are made towards Mother Earth. So let me try and draw some of these diverse themes together, which began with storytelling. When life moves more or less at an ordinary pace, the individual in a family, in a village, in a city, can be part of a kind of connected fabric of life. Themes and variation in the news can be argued about and imagined. Fragments found in news items, Facebook and gossip, while not deep narratives, can nonetheless constitute an imagination of the everyday, such that their storytelling has a certain containing function. But in considerably more stressful times, where massive cruelties are being inflicted in different parts of the world, where neoliberal economics have led to huge increases in inequality, the idea of the hole in the center, as Zizek's story of the flag reveals, may well be felt by individuals as a massive shock that can only be dealt with in primitive ways. As Ferenczi found, the individual reacts to massive trauma with splitting and, in his word, atomization, attempts to create small mental space that is immune, perhaps, and safer from attack. The horrific stories that I've told you about concerning the plight of the Yazidi convey those people's experience in the center of such a tear to the world that they had been living in. They are shocking stories taking place in our world today, and we do not know enough of the details. Vast numbers of the immigrants are moving across the globe, from Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and other countries, and each has their own harrowing story, displacing themselves from torn, dangerous societies to cross borders, countries, seas, hoping for safety and concern. They have a child's belief that by moving away, someone will look after them. When they arrive, many people do want to provide that wished-for care. Yet the migrant's arrival is preceded by an eruption of primitive fantasy in a proportion of the receiving population, fearful of being infected by the terrible experiences that the immigrants are bringing inside their mind. Or, out of sight, out of mind. The result is a right-wing push to keep those Untermenschen away. Their stories must not be heard, because otherwise we might become like them. Or they will drive us out, as they've been driven out. In contrast to such fear-driven spitting that the Yazidi experienced, or the attempt in Lublin to refine lost stories and the histories of murdered citizens, is an après-coup demand for mourning and integration. It's similar to an analytic treatment attempting to map lost terrains in the memories that are split off and repressed. It's painful to remember that Benjamin, despite having obtained a US visa from his friend Max Horkheimer, and despite being just a few miles from crossing the border into Spain, took an overdose of morphine. It seems that for him, that escape to freedom became similarly unimaginable. I will end with one more story, but a story with some hope. There's a walled city of Harar in Ethiopia. The walls were built between the 13th and the 16th century. It's full of very narrow alleyways. One street in the city was known as the Street of Reconciliation. It's particularly narrow, so much so that two people who've had a disagreement are unable to pass each other by without communicating. Having to walk through the narrowing of the passage, the two enemies are unable to avoid physical contact, and in this closeness lies the potential for reconciliation. One can think of the problem that an individual brings to an analysis in the terms of this narrowing of a passage. The passing of time can bring rigidity to a person's thought and behavior with relationships, harking back into early childhood, remaining fundamentally unaltered in the adult, as we've heard. Yet the very persistence of these narrow relationships fixed in the old city of the person's memory gradually allows the possibility of rubbing up against their own fixity within the dyadic relationship with the analyst. New possibilities of relating can be imagined in this space, and a daring project undertaken of loosening, branching out, and widening the sclerotic pathways. This is not to say that all of the person's relationships will blossom. Some connections may refuse to budge due to the continued intransigence of the other. But there are still other, newer pathways that maybe can be moved through. This might allow a person to develop away from the edge, from the border of their identity, and live their emotional life with a freedom that is far from the previous sense of immutability. If such discoveries in the consulting room can be profoundly transformative, perhaps these mental mechanisms can also be applied to individuals within groups and with citizens within nations. A task as psychoanalysts is to continue creating an environment in which there's freedom to imagine the unimaginable in all of its formations as a profound defense against the enactments of cruelty, both in families and in peoples and in nations. Where do you still hear words from the dying that last and that pass from one generation to the next like a precious ring, was Benjamin's thoughtful plea. Psychoanalysis has the potential within its mental techniques to open up and maintain such spaces. Thank you. Yeah.
Still on. Thank you, Jonathan. That was a wonderful paper. I was in a conference a couple of weeks ago on hope, and it was very noticeable in the conference that people were happy to talk about hope or no hope in the consulting room. It was very difficult to get them to talk about it outside the consulting room. But I think there is a danger that doing what we do, we become quietistic, and we just live within the work with the unconscious in the consulting room and don't actually take outside what we can learn there. And so it's very good to hear this call to take our thinking outside and then bring it back in again. But I'm not going to, I could go on forever, but we should get some questions from other people.
Take a few.
Thank you. I'm going to link that really with a thank you to Marika, because it seemed to me that when there can be an assumption that we all agree, and then we live in echo chambers, so we all agree that remaining is the thing to do, and I'm of that school, but I think what might happen is that we fail to engage with the other. And the other poem you mentioned about Grenfell Tower was that sort of sense of fear of contagion of the other, so that we just retreat. And I think in psychoanalysis, when you're talking about working with the unconscious alongside, we have a responsibility to stand up sometimes with our way of thinking in the real world of society. It seems to me, how can we engage in that narrow road in Hurrah, where we actually, instead of talking always to ourselves in our echo chamber, actually go out and talk to people who maybe we think won't agree with us. And I think those two poems really, really made me feel very angry, made me feel very sad, but also made me have an insight too, that we have a requirement to listen not just to our patients, but to others in society who get terribly, terribly frustrated about not being heard.
I'm going to take another question as well, and then we'll see what time we've got for an answer to go on.
I don't know if I'm
still talking up yet. Sorry, it's me again. It's more a combined thing from John's very moving writing, and then Marika. I live close, or I used to live very close to Grenfell. And when it happened, I took my kids there. I've been here for nearly 30 years, but I'm not considered English, or it's not my home anymore. So I took my kids there. Sorry, I'm going to get a bit emotional. And it was very sad because there was people saying that there was a lot more victims than were told by the press or the rescue teams. And the reason was, and that I feel angry, I feel sad. There were immigrants that felt, because they may be illegal, they may have brought friends and family through the sea, through the water, through whatever horrible circumstance, they felt scared to ask for help and to say that their families perished there and that the numbers are very high. And every time I looked at that tower, because I pass every day with my child, I just feel so angry about this. And all this anger that's been taking the world and this open box of demons, I don't know where they come from. But even the thought that where I had my children grow up, I cannot go home because I wasn't born here, even if I may be older than some of the people that vote me to go back to where I came from. So that's what I want to say. Sorry.
Looks like it's a bit of a confessional day today, that we all are opening up, following you. I was born in Argentina, and I feel ashamed about this. And I feel like a Londoner, as a matter of fact. I don't feel the connection, because what John described so well, it did happen there. The Dirty War from 1979 to 1983 was the junta, and there was absolutely, the target was psychoanalysis and the psychoanalysts. Mm. And they disappeared. The children were taken away. I mean, it was just those years of complete. And I tell you, the legacy is still there. So I don't want to go. I mean, the last time I was there for a conference, if you go to any, or try to open it, no, everybody is in terror. In other words, what happened then, the people were disappearing, and people next door, their friends, the flats, they used to say, if there is a, for some reason must be. That was then the usual thing. Por algo será. Hmm? And so, it was an immediate sense of conspiracy, complicity, and corruption. And this cannot be that easily liberated from. It's still going on there. And I tell you, perhaps I had a good sense of smell that I left before any of this happened, because I would be one of the desaparecidos had they stayed there for sure. So it is, there are things that, I mean, that, as you explain, then you see, it has to be psychoanalysis, because psychoanalysis is about the freedom of expression. So if you have that, and I have been just now to Russia, and people don't ask, I don't mean even to complain, they don't ask themselves, everybody's scared. So I'm listening to Radio 3 from there, all about the Soviet Union and all about Russia. In St. Petersburg, nobody said one word about what happened. We had the...
I've got a mic.
Got a mic.
I don't know what I meant to say.
It's the future.
We can't trust in governments in Europe. We can't trust in our government, which is being dominated by right-wing factionalism that's determined to get its way. The whole of Europe seems to be on the edge of right-wing fascistic taking over of governments. All right, I'll end with a personal story. My father told me when I was a little boy that he went on the march when Mosley wanted to take his black shirts into the East End. And the government was full of Tory fascists. So Mosley had his black shirts walking through towards the East End of London, but preceding them were the police. I mean, they led this attack. The East End of London was full of immigrant Jews, it was full of Irish, it was full of Marxists and communists. They all got together. And they said, "You shall not pass." And hearing this story, this heroic story, I was very pleased with my hero father that had stopped them with everybody else. He wasn't on his own. And I thought for many, many years, for perhaps a great deal of my life, I'm so pleased I don't have to do that. That's no longer true. So that's the end of what I want to say. We have to stand up.